Good afternoon, and welcome to Chapter 19, Perek Yud Tet of Job, Week 31. It is on page 1645, if you are in the Stone Tanakh. Right? There was a time when we were on page 1621. Lest you think we're not accomplishing anything, we have turned pages. Yeah, these are big pages, there's a lot on them. Not a small one. Last time around, we read Perek Yud Ches, chapter 18, and that was Bildad's second speech to Eov, to Job, in which he talked about the suffering of the wicked. He began by rebuking, and then he moved into talking about how the wicked people suffer. And he said some things that were really targeted to Eov in kind of a shocking way. Like, in his first speech, he had already sort of said directly, but a little indirectly, that Job has sinned and that his children have sinned if these things have happened to them. That he talked about divine justice and how those who abandon God collapse like a reed without water, but you know, things can end. Well, that was his first speech, to which Job had responded that he wants to sue God and he can't get a date in court and things are unjust, and he offered his challenges. But in his second speech, he really was very harsh. He talked about the wicked losing their home and their family and their skin, which is exactly what Job had experienced. He talked about people being immobilized by their own snares and by the traps of those around them. And now it's time for Job to respond. So is he going to actually speak to Bildad? Or is he going to do what Eliphaz did, which is to say, is he going to talk to what he did with Eliphaz, I should say, which is to talk past him? Is he going to actually address what Bildad said? So if you take a look at source number 2 on your sheet, source number 1 is just an outline of the structure of the chapter. But looking at number 2, Malbim. He says, Gamal Shitat Bildad Lo Arach Tshuvato Adayin. Malbim believes that Job does not respond on point to Bildad. And in fact, why? Ki Chikal Hashiv L'Shloshet Harayim Yachad. He's waiting until the end of the round. And at the end of the round, once they've all spoken, then he's going to respond to all of them, suggesting more of this sort of choreographed version of what's going on, in which it's not about one person speaking and then getting a response, and then another, and it happens to be in order, but this is formal. You know, this is a dance, in which all three of them are going to take their turn, and then Job's going to respond in the end. Rak hitmarmer ma'od al masha machivim oto b'divrim marim u'becherpa vavuz. He says, what happens here, really, is that Job speaks with bitterness against the fact that they pain him, against the fact that they shame him. That's really what Job is doing here. If you could do me a favor, sorry, if you could actually take a different chair, they need two chairs. Thank you. So, within the view of Malbim, there is no. Within the view of Malbim, there is no relationship between what Job says and what Bildad had said first. I don't actually see it that way. Keep in mind, as we've seen before, that Malbim sees many philosophical themes here that the other commentators completely do not see. And that may be why he doesn't see Job responding, because in terms of those philosophical themes, he won't see it in Job's response. But what we're going to see as we look through on a basic text level, not getting into the deep philosophy that Malbim sees here, is we will see, I think, direct responses from chapter 19 to chapter 18. In terms of the chapter itself, the major theme here is something that is new, something we have not seen yet in the dialogues, and that is a plea for sympathy. Haven't seen that so far. Really kind of startling, actually, when you see it for the first time. You know, is this Job? Like, is this the same person we've seen so far? He's been so angry. He's been so negative and so insulting, really, towards his visitors. And now, that's not the face we're going to see. He has already said, we saw in chapter 16 and 17, he said, you know, if I were in your shoes, if I were visiting someone suffering the way that I am suffering, then I would... I would join myself to him with my words. So there was a suggestion of, where's your compassion? But nowhere near the extent that we're going to see here. And what we're going to see is, I think, something you could take in a few different ways. One way you could take this, and I'm rushing it a little bit rather than dialoguing it, only because we have, you know, two sessions left here, and I want to at least get through chapter 20. So what he's saying here could be taken as an expression of burnout. Right? Remember that this is already speech number 5. To which he is responding. In addition to his frustration with their silence, which was itself a problem, now we are also seeing, you know, Eliphaz spoke, he responded. Bildad spoke, he responded. Sophar spoke, he responded. Back to Eliphaz, back to Bildad. Like, to a certain extent, it's just like burnout. Like, I'm tired of fighting with you guys back and forth. I'd rather just, you know, you would have some sympathy, and I could feel like there's a friendship here. And we're going to see that very clearly in, if you take a fast look at verse 3, we're going to come back to verse 3, but just look at the way he words it. Yeah, we're shorter on chairs than usual. I don't know why, but we have to make do, I guess. He says, "Ze eser pe'amim tachlimuni," right? 10 times you have already shamed me. We'll see how you get to the number 10, whether you have to count to 10 or not. That's not the point. The point is, maybe this is a reflection of burnout. I'm so tired of everything that has already happened, and I just want some sympathy. That's one way to take it. Clear? Second way that you could look at it is, what he's saying is, your approach to me reflects a lack of understanding of where I am. And I don't care about the philosophy you're bringing to the table. What has been the theme of Eliphaz and Bildad to date in this round, in round 2? What have they emphasized? The suffering of the wicked, right? The idea that people who do bad things suffer with this sort of veiled message or not so veiled message of, Job, if you're suffering, it's because you did wicked things too. And Job's response is, enough of the philosophy already. You know, you're talking to me about your worldview and your understanding of the way things work, and especially using Newsom's idea that what they're talking about is a statement of overall, this is how the world works, as opposed to what you've experienced, which may just be an anomaly. And he's saying, you know, I don't care how the world works. I care about what's happening to me. And so that's another way to understand his plea for sympathy. And then a third approach would be that this is rebuke. Remember that back in chapter 16, he talked about trial by ordeal, right? He said that my creases, the creases in my skin, the suffering I am enduring is taken as testimony to my guilt. Right? You remember that? It was only chapter 16. It's not that long ago. It is on the final. He said there that you're looking at my suffering as proof of my wickedness. But to me, it's just pain. And therefore, you should be offering me some sympathy. And here I brought a source that has nothing directly to do with Job, but everything to do with this point of view. If you take a look at source number 3 on your sheets, this is from a work called Siach Shlomo. It's a small text. It's available on HebrewBooks.org. Written by a Rabbi Shlomo Kluger. There's a famous Rabbi Shlomo Kluger, the Rabbi of Brod. This is his grandson. His grandson suffered terribly. He suffered from the loss of both parents in separate incidents in his youth. And this is from his eulogy that he gave for his father, who was the second one to die. And he talks about here the ways people approach tragedy. And before the section that I've excerpted here, he talks about people looking at suffering and drawing positive lessons and saying, maybe God is trying to tell me something. And he says the following. Amnam kol ze yitachein b'im yikre lo la'adam prati ason hanogea rak el atzmo uvisaro. As kol asher yiras Hashem nosesa b'kirbo mechuyav la'atzdik elav es hadin ulevarech al hara'a kmo al atova. Ki ze derach kol ish yashar holich lisbol b'menuchat nefesh kol atzlaot ha'baot alav. He says, look, this meaning, this sort of acceptance of what has happened and looking for meaning, he says that's possible if it happens to a particular person, something happens that affects him personally. So if a person is reverent of God, so then he's obligated to try to find some kind of way to accept this as justice and to accept with menuchat ha-nefesh, with a calm spirit, all of the things that happened to him. That I can accept, he says. That if a person suffers personally, so you tell me they're supposed to do that. Achein, however, shod vashavarim yikruvi yasayu al ish val bnei adam yachad. But if terrible things happen to a person and to others, there is a collective disaster. Az ein la ish ahu, av ki pigei azman nichasu bo, yeser mi bezulaso. He says, even if this person suffered more than others did, it is not within his right to say, just like I see a message in my suffering, so too there's a message for them, and therefore I'm not going to be troubled by what they experienced. The fact that you say for yourself, I know that God was sending me a message, and this is just, does not entitle you to say that about other people. To say that he accepts this upon himself with love, he says, that's a terrible thing to do. That is a disgraceful thing to do. It is an ugly thing to do. For a person to say, I accept with love what God has done to you. Right? That's exactly what he's saying. He says, I have news for you. If a person does something like this, then the curse of our sages befalls him. What curse? He quotes you a Gemara. Tanu Rabbanan. The Talmud says, "Bizman shi Yisrael shriin b'tzar." It's a Gemara in Tanis, I believe. When Israel is in pain, upiresh achad mehem, and some person separates from them and says, "Well, I'm not like them." Ba'im shnei malachei asheresu menechim yedehem al rosho. Two angels come along and they place their hands on his head and they say, "Ploni zeh shepiresh min hatzibur al yireh b'nechamat hatzibur." This person who separated from the pain of the community shall not see the consolation of the community either. And he goes on. He talks about there's a passage in the Talmud in Gittin in which they talk about a city called Kfar Sachnia. Now, Kfar Sachnia has a history. It's a very interesting history in early Christian times. But in a passage there, they ask, for what sin was Kfar Sachnia punished? And their answer is, the people of Kfar Sachnia were righteous. However, they didn't mourn for Jerusalem. And the question is, what do you mean? They didn't mourn for Jerusalem. What is that? And he explains that they didn't mourn because they said, you know, they received what was coming to them. Yeah, the Talmud is filled with passages in which the destruction of Jerusalem is associated with a particular crime, right? They were guilty of, the most famous one is sinas chinam, of hating other people for nothing, but all sorts of crimes are associated with the city of Yerushalayim, of Jerusalem. And he says that's the problem. People get wrapped up in the assignment of guilt, and it makes them feel a little bit better about what happened. And they were a little less empathetic. Right, you see it with people sometimes, where there'll be an accident and somebody suffers, and then they'll hear, well, they weren't wearing a seatbelt, or they were using their phone, or whatever it was, and there's almost this reaction of, oh, that's better. You know, now that I'm able to say it wasn't random, it was because of X. Now I don't feel as bad for this horrible tragedy that afflicted them. And what Job is saying, I feel, is a little bit like that to them. He says, you know, you're all philosophizing and seeing guilt in me. And, you know, for all I know, maybe I am guilty. He doesn't really say that ever. But the except one point where he said, maybe I've done a little something wrong, not deserving of all of this. But it's as though he's saying to them, even if, even if you're right, even if I've done things that are wrong, and therefore these are happening to me, you can't stop seeing me as a human being. Right? There still has to be the emotion that comes from seeing a human being suffer. And that's been gone. Now, it's not necessarily entirely gone. We talked about in Eliphaz's first speech when he tries to give Job a narrative of hope, of things can get better. Right? So we did invoke the idea that things could at some point become better, and Eliphaz is trying to say to him, there is hope. But that's not what Job is seeing, and certainly not in the last two speeches in which they've been, you know, telling him all about wicked people suffering. There's been no message of hope in that regard. There's a chair here. There's been no human kindness. And so I see three layers in what Job is doing here by turning to them for sympathy, as we'll see him do in this chapter. He's saying, number one, I am burned out from your accusations, which we'll see him say in verse 3 pretty clearly. Number two, I don't care about philosophy, because philosophy doesn't change what I'm experiencing. And number three, what's wrong with you people that you're coming to me with philosophy instead of putting an arm around? All right, you don't want to put an arm around him, he's got boils. But, you know, there should be some sense of warmth. And so we get the outline that you see that I put here in source number one. You can see the themes. We go from you're making me miserable to I am surrounded and crushed to I am alone without any aid to please help me by at least recording my words to frustration and finally the requisite curse at the end for his visitors. That's the theme. That's what you're going to see. It's a very interesting chapter in terms of language. Some very interesting sentence structure. Some interesting phrases that make it into our liturgy as well. References to other passages in Tanakh. And one particular popular phrase that no one knows comes from Job is going to be here in this chapter. You read ahead. You know where we're going. Don't spoil the surprise. So let's see where this goes. Chapter 19, it is on page 1645 in your Tanakh. He begins with the formal Vayan, Iyo, Vayomar, Job declared and said. Pasuk Bet, sentence 2. Again, the theme in this part is going to be, you are making me miserable. Ad ana togunet nafshi, usdak unani bimilim. How long will you give me tugah, my spirit's tugah? Tugah is? Etzev, agony, pain, yagon, right? This is great sorrow. Usdak unani, you will render me daka. Daka, dalet chafalef, is? Depression, right? Dikaon is the modern word in Hebrew for depression. You are going to depress me with your words. And again, I love the way he does this with the Hebrew. In terms of the terms that he uses, togiyun and tidaki unani, invoking these words for the sorrow they're giving him with their words. And he says in the sentence that I referred to before, Pasuk Gimel, sentence 3, ze eser pe'amim tachlimuni, 10 times you have shamed me. Lo sevoshu, you yourselves are not ashamed at all. Tahkiru li, the word tahkiru is a very strange word. It is generally taken as a reflection of the word nechar, to be a stranger. You act as a stranger to me. Okay, so where are the 10? You have shamed me 10 times.
The five, three of their speech, plus his 5 answering, and 10.
Okay, is that, Alina, you going to say that also?
I was
going to
say that between what they said and what he answered, you know, like, I think it's been 5, yeah.
Right, so technically this is number 11 then, because he spoke first. So it's there have been 10 speeches. The problem I have with that answer is what? Yeah, Shayna? Yeah, he said half of them. They're not shaming him 10 times. So what would you answer? Well, that's no good. It can't just be 5, because he said. Well, there are no euphemisms in this book. There are only malphemisms in this book.
Sometimes we just throw out a number.
Right. So we did have euphemism at the beginning with the bracha as a blasphemy. But the but yes, it could just be this is a big number. Right? In fact, in the Torah, when Hashem gets fed up with the Jews, at one point he says, "Vayinasu osi ze eser pyamim." They have tested me 10 times, and they haven't listened to me. So you could sit there and try to count up, you know, to 10, but you could also say it just means a large number, and that's one way to look at it.
How about umpteen?
Sorry? Umpteen, yeah. So we don't have umpteen in Hebrew, we say 10. Yeah.
Metaphorically, the eser makros.
Right. Well, except that there you actually have 10.
Yes.
So that won't work for me. But the other answer could be what that mikra suggests, which is his speeches count because they don't accept his words. That is also a shaming of him. I spoke and you didn't listen to me, and that's the biggest offense you can give to someone in this book is when they give you their speech and you don't listen to them. That's what they're all busy doing to each other. So it's really been a tenfold experience of shaming. If you take a look on your sheet, I brought you in source number 4, Ibn Ezra quoting Rav Sadia Gaon, Amar Gaon Rav Sadia Zal. If you take his speeches and their responses, or however you look at it, right? Because he spoke first, but really it's separate. But however you read it, the bottom line is there are 10 different speeches until now. But then he says, that's Rav Sadia Gaon, it appears correct in my eyes to say, like in the first of the Tochachot, the warnings of punishment that are brought in the Torah, when God says, this is going to happen to you if you stray. So there's a prediction of 10 women baking in a single oven. It's an expression of poverty. And so there it says 10 women. Does that mean this is a prediction that there are 10 women in, you know, to each oven? No, it just means a lot of women are going to have to share the same oven, which reflects number one lack of ovens, but more to the point lack of bread, right? Because if they can all fit what they have in one oven, it means that you don't have a whole lot of bread to go around. So, heyot cheshbon asur asach cheshbon. He says 10 just means a total. It's a whole number. That's all that we're really getting at here. Shana.
When Yaakov finally rebelled against Lavanda, he said, "You changed my
wages." Good. Hechlif et maskurti aseret monim. Right. You have changed my salary 10 times. Good. Another good example. Thank you. So so that's a distinct possibility. So now we've got what? We have Zeser Pyamim from God to the Jews. We have the example of Yaakov that Shana gave, and then we have the example that we see in Ibn Ezra himself, Ba'afu Eser Nashim. So that already gives us a good basis for saying it's just a round number. So he says to them, concluding this section, Va'af Omnam Shagisi. As I said, there are times when he says, I have sinned, maybe. He says, even if I sinned, I can't help thinking of OJ. He says, even if I have sinned, iti talin mishugasi, my sin lies with me. Do not confuse this for mishuga. Those are two different words. Mishuga is a Hebrew word, but it went with an ayin. From shigaon, mishugati is like the word shogeg, a mistake. My mistake rests with me. What is he saying when he says this? Even if I have sinned, my sin rests with me. What's his message?
When a person has sinned, he discusses this between him and God. It's his sin, and God judges him, and he resolves this between him and God, and it's frankly not there.
So that, right. So what Rita says was my instinct. As he said at the end, it's none of your business. It's, you know, between me and God. None of the commentaries take that explanation. Ralph, you were going to say?
It's nothing to do with it.
That's exactly what I would have thought is the meaning of the sentence. But the commentaries tend to take it a little bit differently, and I think because they're looking for something that will fit into the context a bit more. And what they say is some version of, it varies slightly commentary to commentary, but what they say is, you don't know what I've done wrong. If I've sinned at all, it's in here. You don't actually have anything on me. As reflected by the fact that we've been through these, you know, 5 rounds, 10 speeches, and you have yet to actually identify a sin for me. You said there must be one, because if you're suffering, you must have done something wrong. But we have yet to see. Don't worry, it's going to happen. But to this point in the book, no one has been able to say to Job, here is what you have done wrong. And so he says, you're all up in the air philosophy here, bashing me, saying you've done something wrong, you've shamed me, you've acted as strangers to me, and you have nothing on me. So what's going on? What is this for? Clear? That's the opening segment. Now, as I've said in other chapters, there are different ways to break down the segments within a chapter, and you could legitimately break this down a little bit differently. As I've said, I'm doing it based on what I see and the way that I read the verses. But the next section is a glaring unit. This is remarkable here, what he's going to do. And keep in mind, as we read it, what we saw in chapter 18, verses 7 to 11. If you go back to there for a second, because I don't expect everyone to remember what we saw in chapter 18, sentence 7 to 11. The theme there was of the snares and traps. Right? So what Bildad had said to him is that the wicked person faces all sorts of traps, and we noted at the time the number of different Hebrew words that he uses to describe traps. In sentence 8, he had the reshet, the svacha, right? Netting of some kind. The pach in sentence 9, the tsamim in sentence 9, the hevel and the malkodet in sentence 10. It's all about being surrounded by snares. So he can't move anywhere, he can't go anywhere. Saviv in sentence 11, he is surrounded by frightening things, perhaps demons, depending on how we explain the word balahot. So what we're seeing here in sentences 7 to 11 in the previous chapter is Bildad saying to him, wicked people are surrounded. There is no safe step for them. Keep that in mind now as we read what happens in this next segment. And to make life easier, take a look at what I brought you in source number 6. What I wanted to show you here is that I believe what's going on is a poem of sorts with rotating themes. His opening line in this section, sentence 5, is going to speak of being crushed and surrounded. Sentence 6, he's going to talk about being surrounded. Sentence 7, he's going to talk about being crushed. 8 will be about being surrounded. 9 will be about being crushed. 10 will be about being surrounded. 11 will be about being crushed. And then in 12, he's going to unify them again. Which, again, as we discussed regarding the overall choreography, lends to the idea that this is not a recording of actual speeches as much as it is either made up entirely, just this is what we hypothesize would happen, it's a parable, or it's someone taking a dialogue that took place and refining it. Because really, it's hard to believe someone spoke this way, particularly with what he was experiencing. On the other hand, they are all planning their responses while the other one is speaking, so it's entirely possible that he had the time to come up with a poem while Bildad was going on. But let's see what he does. He begins, Pasuk Hey, sentence 5. Im omnam alai tagdilu, visochichu alai cherpasi. He speaks of alai tagdilu, you rise up upon me, around me. Alai, the word alai, on me, doesn't mean literally they're on top of him. It's an expression of aggression in which they are all around him. And tochichu alai cherpasi, you rebuke me, you bring my shame to light. And that's what I mean when I talk about the crushing. It's not just a physical crushing, but it's an overall suffering of violence. And so in sentence 6, he speaks about being surrounded. He says, "D'u eifo ki eloka ivtani." You should know, God has cheated me. You keep talking about justice. God is the one who is the agent of injustice. He is the one who has been corrupt with me. And then the surrounding word, umitsudo alai hikif, a mitsuda, right? A mitsuda is a fortress. He has surrounded me with his fortress, with his barriers. You could also take it from the word seda, which is directly a trap. You could read it as a trap or a fortress. Either way, it serves the purpose. The point is that he is surrounding me. The word hikif is the key. The word l'hakif is to be on one's boundary. So what he's saying is that God is unjust, and that God has surrounded me with his fortress or with his traps. Are we clear? I want to make sure I'm not going too much into the poetry and, you know, missing what we're saying. In sentence 7, he goes back to the violence he has suffered. Hein etzak Hamas. Velo eyaneh. I cry out that Hamas is being done to me, a word which we've seen quite a bit in this book. And no one answers me. Ashava, I cry out, ve'ein mishpat, and there is no justice. The Dan Mikra commentary recommends that you look at the third chapter in Eicha, where the person who has suffered such loss laments and says, Gadar ba'adi v'lo eitzei, he has fenced me in, I can't get out. Gam ki ezak v'ashaveya sasam tefilasi, even when I cry out, my prayers are sealed in. So, it's another way in which this is done. But frankly, I think that's one reference. There are many you could bring. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
What? Eicha, Lamentations, chapter 3, sentences 7 and 8. And he just wanted to show the link that we see here between the attacks of others and the being surrounded by others, and then be calling out and no one responding. Here he speaks of Hamas, which we've identified as this sort of violence that comes with theft. We talked about it a lot last year in our classes on Midrash. Pasuk Chet, sentence 8, he goes back to the immobility and being trapped. Orchi gadar, velo evor, he fences in my paths and I can't cross. Va'al nisivosai, and upon my nitivot, upon my paths, right? Kol nitivotei ha-shalom. Upon my paths, choshech yasim, he places darkness, and therefore I can't go. Right? So again, he's gone back to being fenced in. I didn't see anybody who talked about this alternation here, but it's so clear to me that that's what's going on. This going back and forth between the themes of the violence he suffers and being surrounded. He goes in sentence 9, he goes back to the violence once again. Kvodi me'alai hivshit. He has stripped me of my honor, my dignity. Vayasar ateres roshi. He removed the crown from my head. He's stripped of his honor. He's stripped of his dignity.
It's almost same as in Eicha.
Well, yes, we see the ideas of loss of dignity there too. You're right. Quite true. Yeah?
Because his crown as a rulership.
Yes.
Who was he ruling?
What do you think? Go back to the beginning of the book.
Like his family? Like he was the head of his family and rich and all of that? He ruled the kingdom.
Right. Right. So I think what Metzudat David is dealing with when he says this is simply that what crown could you possibly be talking about? Is there a physical crown? We haven't seen anything about crowns.
Right.
But what we have seen is that he had thousands and thousands of animals and servants to go with it and so on. It's not so much ruler as in king as it is somebody with a domain.
Oh, okay.
That's the way I would look at it. So, what he says is that, again, we're still midway in this poem, but what he's saying is that this, you know, I have had violence done to me, and I am surrounded, I can't go anywhere. And so that was on the violence front, the stripping of his honor that we saw there in chapter 19, sentence 9. But then in sentence 10, he goes right back again into being surrounded. Yit tseini saviv. He destroys me from all around, right? Lintots is to knock down. So yit tseini saviv va'elach. He knocks me down all around va'elach. Doesn't mean I go somewhere, because I can, I'm surrounded. It means lalechet li'ibud. It means he's going down to destruction. Vayasaka eit tikvati. He has removed my hope. There's that word tikva, which we've seen over and over again in this book, a major word throughout the book. He has removed it like a tree. What does that mean, removing it like a tree?
Like a
Oh, yeah. Sorry?
In 14, it's the exact opposite.
Yeah.
Because that's the tree that remains. It may be chopped down, but it remains and it gets water. Actually, there's one on the corner of Shelburne and Bedford, which is a perfect example because they basically cut down the whole thing. And it starts sprouting, and it's very green right now. But if you really uproot it,
right, it's like those maples in my yard. That's what we're talking about. We should do a field trip. But you're right. The image of the tree throughout this book has been that which we grow. Bildad loves that image. And remember, he's talking to Bildad. Right? Don't forget that. In chapter 8, Bildad talks about the tree that is transplanted from point A to point B, and it actually grows better in point B. In the previous chapter, Bildad did it again. However, remember that when he responded to Bildad the first time, he said, I'm not like a tree. He said, I'm like a stone or like a mountain, like dirt. And you take it away and it's gone and nothing's going to regrow. And what he's saying here, perhaps, is it's like when the tree is transported from point A to point B and therefore nothing will grow. I didn't cut it down such that the trunk is still there. Instead, we uprooted it. If you take a look on your sheet, flip to the second side, please. Source number 7, Mitzudat David. Akar mi meni tikvasi. He has uprooted my hope from me. Kumo hamasiya la'akor eitz ilan mimikomo. Like somebody who wants to uproot a tree from its place. Asher lo yashuva limikomo. He's not going back. Letak o shuv kishaya. For it to be put in back the way it was. I am not going to get to go back to the way I was. And that, of course, is a veiled foreshadowing, right, of the end of the book for those who have read ahead. No matter what he's going to be given, he isn't going to have what he had in the beginning. It's not the same kids. Paul.
In literature, a tree is something that connects heaven and earth.
Mm.
It's rooted in the earth, but it aspires towards the heaven. So it feels like a tree uprooted. Means that his connection to anything transcendental or
interesting
is gone.
That's a very interesting idea. It certainly adds a dimension to the way we're taking this. And it's certainly true in the sense that what made Job special in the first place, a theme which we're going to come back to at the end of the book, what we're going to see at the end of the book is this desire for a relationship with God. And so what he has lost in all of this is that relationship, because he has come to believe either, depending on how you take it, either that God isn't watching at all, there's no relationship, or that the relationship is a negative, that God is actually corrupt and harming him inappropriately. So his tree, in that sense, if I take tree as the relationship between heaven and earth, his tree has been decidedly uprooted. So that would certainly fit very well. Thank you. We continue, because we're not done with his little poem here. In Pasuk Yud Aleph, sentence 11, he goes back to, once again, the violence done to him. Vayachar alai apo. That is a fun word to translate, that first word in the sentence. What do you have in your translations for vayachar, the first word in sentence 11?
Kindled.
He kindled against me his rage. What else do you have? That's a good one, but I want to make a point with it. Same? Okay. In Hebrew, usually, when somebody is angry, you will say vayichar. Mm-hmm. Right? Or vayichar, technically. Alai apo. But that's not what it says here. Vayachar suggests he aroused his rage against me. In other words, he shouldn't have been angry at me. There was nothing to be upset about. He had to make himself upset at me. He had to go looking for something. He builds his rage at me. Vayachshaveni lo chitzarav. He considered me like his enemies. Plural, not just one. He considered me like his enemies, meaning God created this. It's fictitious. I never was his enemy. He trumped up charges against me. He went looking for reasons to be angry at me. He viewed me as his enemy in order to build the case against me. And so we get Pasuk Yud Bet, where he finishes what I believe is this sort of mini poem. Yachad yavohu gidudav vayasolu alai darkam. His forces all come against me together, and they pave their road upon me. And again, alai doesn't really mean physically on me. Rather, it's a reference to surrounding me. Vayachanu saviv le'aholi, and they camp around my tent. And so he has brought together the two themes, the forces that are crushing him and the surrounding. That's what we've seen in this section is, whether you buy my idea that this is an alternating poem or not, doesn't matter. But the themes that we're seeing here is clearly a combination of the forces that are crushing me and the way I am surrounded and therefore I cannot even move. And what he's doing is, going back to the opening part of this chapter, appealing for sympathy and saying, you've shamed me, you act like you're strangers. The other term there that he had used, right? You've made me depressed. That's what he says. He says, what for? Look at what I'm going through. Look at what God is doing to me unjustly. He has made sure to stick in that it's unjust. Why would you want to visit me in order to make things worse? You follow? And then we continue. But I hope you also see how that was a response to Bildad now, right? Because Bildad said to him, the wicked are surrounded by snares, right? And he took pains to actually spell that out verse after verse. The wicked are surrounded by snares. I like sound effects. And now he's saying, I am surrounded by snares, but I'm not wicked. And then we get to his next section. Sentences 13 to 20. When he says, not only am I suffering, but I am alone. I have no aid. And the theme here is going to be estrangement. As we read through this, I wrote it already on your sheet, or I would ask you to see it, but I blew it. I put it on the sheet. The magic word in this section is the word zar. What does zar mean? A stranger, correct. A stranger. We're going to see it in this brief section here, sentences 13 to 20. He's going to use the word three times. Because that's the key here, is that everybody is estranged from him. A zar in the Torah is like when a non-Kohen does the service in the temple. So he's called a zar. He is a foreigner. He is an outsider who has invaded. So he says in sentence 13... Oh, and there's also going to be a great structure here, but we'll read through it first, and then we'll see the structure. Sentence 13, he says, Achai me'alai hirchik. He, God, has distanced my brothers from me. V'yod'ai, and those who know me, ach zaru mimeni, have been estranged from me. They've become strangers. Rashi here suggests, ach zar, is what becomes a compound word, achzar, which is one who is cruel. Achzar, only a stranger. Interesting. But he says, they are all only estranged from me. God has done this to me. Pasuk Yudalit, sentence 14. Chadlu krovai, those who had been my relatives, close to me, not necessarily relatives, by blood, he's going to get to them later. But those who have been close to me, they've stopped being around. Umiyuda'ai, and those who knew me or who I knew, depending on how you take this odd form of miyuda, but shechechuni, they used to know me, now they've forgotten me. Right? I don't appear in their address book anymore. Page out of the Rolex, and all the different metaphors you want to give. Rita.
I have a question about that.
Yeah.
He's saying God has strange things, or is it their own free will?
Maybe he has thought. But he's saying God is. Yes,
he's pinning it on God.
However, his opening sentences that we saw blamed them for reacting as they did, because what he's saying is God gave them the catalyst, but they chose how to respond. Well, he's blaming God for triggering it, but he's really blaming them in the sense that this whole chapter is directed at them and at assigning guilt to them for their estrangement. If you take a look at source number 9, I think it actually becomes more clear in Mitsudat David's comment. Harking back to what we saw, and I referenced earlier in chapter 16, about trial by ordeal, and the idea that people look at his suffering and take that as evidence of his guilt. So Mitzudat David here says, Gidudei hamachov, and I think you can translate gidud in two ways, either as legions or as cuts, and I think either one works, so therefore I didn't choose one, I just gave you both. Gidudei hamachov, hirchiku me'alayas kerovai. These legions or the cuts that caused me pain, they distanced those who had been close to me from me. Because I suffer in this way, they think I must be wicked. As indeed is seen in their speeches. So what he's saying is, because I've suffered in this way, that's what causes people to leave me, to abandon me. But he's not done. This is a long segment here. He says, Garei Vesi, those who dwell in my house. This is not a reference to family. We say in the Haggadah, Lo yarad Yaakov avinu lishtakeya b'mitzrayim ela lagursham. Yaakov descends to Egypt, lagursham, because that's the term that's used in the Torah. Lagur suggests Gerim, strangers, temporary dwellers. Ger v'toshav anochi imachem, Abraham says. Lagur as a verb means to dwell, but it suggests a dwelling which is temporary. Garei beisi means people who are passing by who I took in. They stayed in my house for a while. Garei beisi, ve'am hosai, and my maids. Lizar tachshivuni, they consider me a zar. That's the second use of zar. Nochri ayisi beinehem, I was a stranger in their eyes. Sentence 16. Le'avdi karasi velo ya'aneh, I call my servants, they don't answer. B'mo fi, that word mo we've seen elsewhere here in the book, it's a strengthening word. B'mo fi eschanen lo, with my very mouth, I plead with him. And Dat Mikra notes here the change in verbs. In the first half of the sentence, I call to them. It sounds like he's calling his servants. He's summoning them. They don't answer. I plead with them. Still no answer. No matter what I do, they have no interest in me. They view me as servants. I saw in the Dat Mikra, he was wondering, does that mean that Job still has servants? Frankly, I'm not sure. I think this is poetic. He's describing his misery and his loneliness. It's not so much a statement of, there's a slave over there in the corner and he's not responding when I call him. And then he continues, Ruchi zara li'ishti. My spirit is foreign, and there's that word zar for the third time. My spirit is foreign to my wife. A throwback to Bildad's statement, right, when Bildad said his wife is going to leave him also in the previous chapter. So that's what we're seeing here, that he's saying, my wife sees me as a stranger. V'chanosi livnei vitni, and my chain, my charm, is also estranged from bnei vitni, the children of my womb, so to speak. He's a male, but
you're
gone. So Dat Mikra asks that question and offers a suggestion. Sharon's question is, there are no kids left. So that Mikra suggests that maybe he had children from another marriage. In other words, keep in mind, this is still back in polygamous times. It could be there were others. My answer would just be just like with the servants. It's just an expression of his loneliness. You know, it isn't a statement of, literally, there are kids there and they're running around and not listening to me. Rita.
Okay, I'm
yes, mission accomplished.
To his friends, I expect you to have some sympathy on me.
Yep.
Then, he says, he doesn't. He understands why people who are in a position that he is in now would be estranged from him.
So is he stating, when you say he understands?
Well, like he says, yeah, but that's what you just said, unless I'm misunderstanding it, that people who are in this position are estranged from people.
We're both using the word understand, but we're using it in different ways.
Okay.
Meaning, I can understand in the sense that I perceive the logical steps that bring, or not even the logical steps, but I perceive the steps that take us from cause to effect. That doesn't mean that I think they're right and that I accept them as appropriate. So he perceives that because he is suffering, they believe he must be wicked. But he doesn't accept that that's an appropriate response. Yeah, Sharon, Susan.
It says here, which I thought was interesting, that there's an Arabic meaning for the word children, and it means clan.
Mm-hmm.
So he's saying it's not really.
Oh, so B'nai doesn't have to mean his children as much as it can mean more of his family. Okay, good.
There's a whole bunch of explanations
for that. Great. Okay, thank you. And then the next sentence here, in Pasuk Yichet, sentence 18, Gam avilim ma'asuvi, akuma vayedabruvi. The word avilim is a problem word in this context. What do your translations do with avilim?
Urchins.
Sorry?
Urchins.
Urchins. Okay, that's a good one, actually. I like that.
Youths.
Not just that it's a good word. What? Youths. Okay, the youths. We have youths, and we have urchins. So the problem with this word is that avilim normally is used, like the word in Tehillim, avlata, right? Zriv lo avlata bo, is used to connote corruption. Avil, right. The problem is that he's talking about the people who abandon him. He has named them, so to speak, only by their relationship with him. He has not talked about anybody as good or bad. It doesn't fit the context. And so, some take it, and Dad Mikra offers you various sources to support it. Some suggest it means youths, those who are young. And it would fit with this, you know, the previous sentence where he talked about B'nai Vitni, his children. But what do I do with the negative that's associated with Avilim? What I'll do is to say urchins. So it isn't just kids, but it's bad kids. Urchins has this sort of connotation of kids who get into a lot of trouble. So maybe that's the way to understand Avilim, but it's a problem word.
Maybe it's also a little bit of tongue-in-cheek because he is blaming his friends for blaming him for something unknown. So he's saying here that even bad guys don't like me.
Yeah. Oh, so even the bad guys.
I'm too bad for them. I mean, right. What's the sense here?
Right, and that's the way I would have taken it, in all honesty, if not for the context. Because he doesn't, in this entire segment, he doesn't pass.
Me.
Yeah. If what, sorry?
No, so it sounds to me, I mean, that even these bad guys, you know, I'm even too bad for them.
Right. No, that I understand.
I think it's ironic.
Okay, could be. Could be. Yeah. Sentence 19 and 20 are where he concludes this segment, and I really wanted to get to 20 today. He says, Tiavuni kol misei sodi. He says, all those who are, the people who are in on my secrets, they are tiavuni, they abhor me. Vize ahavti, the one I loved, Nechubi, they have turned on me. And then he concludes the sentence, the section, Be'ori uvivisari davka atzmi. My bones stick to my hide and my flesh. Ve'es malta, and I flee, I escape. Be'or shinai, by the skin of my teeth. You all wondered where the phrase, by the skin of, where does that phrase come from? The answer is Job. That is the origin of the phrase. Yes. You can impress your friends. Yeah, Job, I think it's chapter 19. I don't know. Yeah. And the commentaries to it don't all read it this way, the way that we use it colloquially. Rashi says it means my gums. All I have left are my gums. That's the skin of my teeth. Ralbag says, the only skin I have left is that which cleaves to the roots of my teeth. Again, also the gum reference. But Ibn Ezra renders it the way we do, in the popular form. That I only escape by the skin of my teeth. That's all I have. But in terms of what he's done here, I want to make sure that we're clear about what he has done in this section. Go back, please. Sentences 13 to 20, and tell me something. Do you see a pattern at all in terms of who it is who he describes as abandoning him? Can you identify a pattern? Is it all people who are close to him?
Close to
him. He's got... He's a pariah, true, but what else?
They're all those who are closest to him.
Also those who are distant.
He's alone. He doesn't have anybody to comfort him. He's by himself and suffering alone without even strangers giving him respect or regard.
Right, but I heard Paul out to say something.
It goes from people farther away to people the closest.
So I would tweak that a little bit and say it's he increases in terms of those from whom I would have expected more. He starts out with the people he has no claim on, and then he goes down. So in sentences 13 and 14, he talks about those who are his equals. His ach, his yodai, they knew me. Krovai, they were people who were close to me, right? But they were not necessarily people he had any claim on. They're just people who are his equals. Then he gets to the people who are his inferiors. The people I took into my house to take care of while they were passing through. My maids, my slaves. Then he goes on in sentences 17 and 18 to talk about his family. He says his wife, his children, and that's where Avilin would fit better again if it is the youths, as opposed to saying that it's the wicked, but understanding that this is just my way of reading it. And then in 19, he goes into the people I took into my confidence. I divulged my secrets to them. I loved them. All of them betrayed me. I've got nothing left. And he's turning to these three people, and now let's think back to the beginning of the book, right? The visitors who showed up at his doorstep as he was suffering. And he thought, they're going to comfort me. And what did they do? They opened their mouths and said, you know, Job, you got to get closer to God. That's the way you have to deal with this. You have to see what you've done wrong, because there's divine justice in this world, and then worse, in the second round, you know, wicked people suffer, Job. Writing's on the wall, to borrow from, you know, we did Daniel 2 years ago. Yes?
He also feels abandoned by God.
Very much so, but he hasn't mentioned that here. That's not, you're right. But he hasn't thrown into this particular section. And so what he's going to do is he's going to ask them for something in the next section. We've hit our mark here in terms of the hour. But what we're going to see him do is make a request of them to cure his hopelessness that he now has. What I would like to do, against all odds perhaps, is do the rest of 19 and 20 next week, so that what we will have accomplished is at least we got to the end of their speeches in round two. Before we do our break for the summer, I will hopefully present as well a little summary of where we've been all through to help us sort of catch up and make sure we don't lose track of the flow. That will be, God willing, next week. Thank you very much.